Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with The Age of Ignorance, the title of an article in the New York Review of Books by Charles Simich, the 15th Poet Laureate of the United States. We discuss his 40-year experience in teaching college students, where he finds that students coming out of high school know less and less every year. Then we'll be joined by a former Secretary of the Air Force who headed the super-secret National Reconnaissance Office and was a special assistant to President Reagan for national security policy. A former nuclear weapons designer, Thomas Reed, will discuss his new book, Tehran Triangle, and the extent and nature of Iran's secret nuclear weapons program. Then, finally, we will speak with John Schenck, the filmmaker of a new feature documentary, The Island President, that closely followed Mohamed Nasheed's first year as president of the Maldives, an island nation gradually being swallowed by the Indian Ocean due to the effects of global warming. We will discuss this heroic man's effort to save his country and alert the world to the peril of climate change. Joining us now is Charles Simich, a poet, essayist, and professor emeritus of American literature and creative writing at the University of New Hampshire. He has published some 20 collections of poetry, 6 books of essays, a memoir, and numerous translations. Charles Simich is the recipient of many awards, including the Pulitzer Prize, the Griffin Prize, and the MacArthur Fellowship. And in 2007, he was appointed the 15th Poet Laureate of the United States. His most recent works are Voice at 3 a.m., Master of Disguise, and Confession of a Poet Laureate. And he has an article in the New York Review of Books, Age of Ignorance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Simich.
Nice to be there.
So your article, Age of Ignorance, is, of course, accompanied in the New York Review of Books by a photograph of Sarah Palin appearing with Sean Hannity at the Iowa State Fair. And just yesterday, Sarah Palin hosted the Today Show on NBC, up against Katie Couric on the Rival Network, and we know about their past. Are ignoramuses being anointed now with mainstream respectability in the United States?
Oh, I think so. I mean, the less you know, the sky's the limit. You can go, you can go all the way to the presidency. This is definitely the trend, the new trend.
So do you think that John McCain opened that door? And is there a historic landmark here in terms of, my understanding is from going back to the founding fathers of this country, who were a pretty exceptional bunch of people, many of them were quite intellectual. And it seems to me that there's been a sea change here where people now have permission to vote for people who are just like them, as opposed to vote for people who are better educated and more qualified than they are.
Well, I agree completely. Although, I mean, as you know, we have had presidents who were sort of boobs. You know, Harding was not too smart, and Cal Coolidge likewise, and. In the 19th century, too, there was some, you know, there was some, you know, fairly mediocre, you know, presidents. But this is something new. I mean, what was amazing about, Sarah Palin and she, I mean, I had students like that. I mean, I met people like that. I mean, people who not only don't know anything, but they have no desire to find out. And what surprised me was that she, you know, even given the opportunity, you know, to be, you know, run on a ticket like that, you would think that she would make an effort to learn a few things. But as, you know, the people who were handlers, her handlers and so forth, in the, you know, after she was nominated, I mean, they realized that she had no desire whatsoever to, you know, curiosity to, you know, to find out about certain things. I mean, there's just some, you know, stuff that, you know, a lot of people who, you know, pay attention to the news or who, you know, read the papers or whatnot to watch, you know.
Well, what explains that, though, Charles Simich, that here you are, heartbeat away from an elderly president, assuming that McCain had won, and that you have no interest in learning about the real world? What explains that kind of hubris.
I mean, that kind of hubris exists. What is more interesting, what's incomprehensible? First of all, that she gets elected for governor of a state. Then that she is brought in to be a vice president. And then that you have all these people who continue to admire her. I mean, you know, I've had, and anybody who's taught school, I mean, has had students who are just not very bright, and there's nothing you can do about them. They're mentally lazy, or they're not pretty bright, whatever it is. And you know, no subject, no teacher can shift them from that, you know, that kind of state of mind. And so that's all, you know, that's the way it goes. I mean, that's, you know, it's, they're a small number, you know, in any classroom, and it was teaching experience, but they exist. But I, being, you know, foolish, you know, at the age of 74, and, you know, I kind of expected the people to be appalled by her, you know, by her ignorance. I mean, I don't want to have somebody who potentially has power over me who knows nothing. I mean, it's like, you know, going to see a doctor and not caring at all if this doctor, you know how to hold a stethoscope or whatever, you know?
Right.
I mean, it's sort of mad. It's nuts. I mean, I was frightened. I was just, I mean, how can you, you know, the people, I was frightened by the people, I should say, who were, you know, cheering for her.
The real Americans, right?
Struck me as being you.
The real Americans.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what she calls them. I mean, you know, I mean, we always had people, right, you know, kind of, I mean, I talk about that. I mean, we always had people in this country who were ignorant, but I mean, who knew nothing, but, you know, they were not asked for their opinion. They were not regarded as the ones who, you know, who have the truth, who have a real understanding, who are closer to reality than the rest of us. And that has changed. I mean, this sort of admiration of you know, of ignorance, of not knowing anything, as if knowledge is dangerous and subversive, and you know, knowing just the most basic facts about American history, or about, you know, just the way the country is run, or what happens, you know, in our foreign policy and so forth and so on. I mean, all this has become suspicious. I mean, knowledge has become suspicious. And the interesting thing to me, you know, in a comment section, you know, this is actually a blog that I wrote, not an article, but a blog. And, you know, there were, like, I think as of yesterday, 265 comments. And, and you know, comments, all sorts of, you know, pro, against, I mean, in between, and so forth and so on. And I noticed that the people who completely agreed with me were people who taught school. I mean, either they taught high school or, you know, college or even grade school. They knew exactly what I was talking about, this tremendous shift, this sort of difference, how much less, you know, not just students know, but even their parents.
Well, that's the point that you make in your article, or your blog, I should say, Charles Simich, Age of Ignorance, in the New York Review of Books. You say that you've taught college for over 40 years, and that the kids that are coming in every year seem to be dumber and dumber.
Well, I don't I wouldn't say dumber. They're just more ignorant.
Ignorant.
They're as nice as kids as ever, perhaps even nicer. I mean, they're sort of, this is what breaks your heart. I mean, they're sort of children, you know, you wouldn't mind having as your own children, be part of your family. It's not their fault. I mean, you know, it's our system or whatever. You know, they got screwed along the way. I mean, there were comments, people saying, well, you know, maybe we need some new way of, you know, teaching them some new way to, you know, approach them and this and that. Well, you know, that's nice to say, but what are you going to do with, you know, with students who do not know what comes first, Second War or Vietnam War, who do not know that England is an island?
Sure.
Well, you know, I mean, there are like about 100 other things. I mean, that, you know, my colleagues and I used to sit around and just, you know, people would repeat this incredible story. You hear them, you just almost don't believe. But I don't think it's their fault. I mean, it's the fault of, you know, forces outside of them. I mean, they're just, you know, just the consequences of you know, the kind of education they get in high schools, and you know, there they are. I mean, they're handicapped, really.
But we have politicians today running to become president of the United States who are celebrating that kind of ignorance. I mean, and castigating this mythical educated liberal elite. Rick Santorum called the president an elitist
and a snob.
And a snob because he says he wants people to go to college.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the education used to be respected. But look at the way teachers, I mean, you know, high school teacher and grade school teachers have become the great enemy, you know. One of the comments on the blog, one fellow says, he says, Mr. Smith forgets, you know, what the unions have done to, you know, to teaching in this country. The notion that, you know, the unions were responsible for the change in the curriculum and the teachers. And then there's this sort of myth that teachers make a lot of money, they don't do any work, they're lazy, they're incompetent, and so forth and so on. So, I mean, I cannot think of if there's another country in the world where teachers are the enemy, education is the enemy. I go on and say, you know, if you want to, you know, if you have a country where the political system is pretty much broken, it's corrupt, broken, an educated population is will be a danger. To that system. I mean, how could you, you know, sure, continue to run it the same way, get away with the kind of, you know, small and big crimes, or, you know, if you had a alert, well-informed, you know, voters, a population. So that also has been one of the reasons, I mean, why the spread of ignorance. The spread of ignorance is intentionally spread. I mean, there's a lot of lying, a lot of propaganda. I mean, if you turn on television and you watch political, you know, advertisements, I mean, you know, most of it is, you know, just lies. It's not...
Sure. Well, you know, the first campaign commercial that Mitt Romney made completely distorts what Obama is saying. Obama was quoting John McCain.
Of course. It makes no difference. You know, yeah, lies work. I mean, they know that lies work. People don't...
Right. But they're not sanctioned
sufficiently. They will not...
But the society
really
doesn't...
Right. So, you know, it's... again, to come back to these poor students, I mean, the students are really just a reflection of this larger problem.
Well, you could probably make the case. I mean, my problem with Romney is that the society doesn't seem to sanction this kind of flagrant and cynical lying. But you could make the case that the Republicans have made a wise investment in ignorance.
Well, they have.
I'll read you a list in your article, just to give the audience an exempt. This is from Charles Simich's blog in the New York Review of Books, Age of Ignorance. Christians are persecuted in this country. The government is coming to get your guns. Obama is a Muslim. Global warming is a hoax. The president is forcing open homosexuality in the military. Schools push left-wing agenda. Social Security is an entitlement, no different from welfare. Obama hates white people. Life on Earth is 10,000 years old, and so is the universe. The safety net contributes to poverty. The government is taking money from you and giving it to sex-crazed college women to pay for their birth control. I mean, you know, this is that's a digest of what's been going on in cable news for the last month.
You know, it took me, you know, all of like 60 seconds to think of all of those. Yeah. I mean, there was no mental effort, because you know, one could list another 50, you know, sure, idiocies, you know, and but it is incredible. I mean, it's just, it's, I mean, when you realize, and, you know, this is not, of course, the first election when I realized this, but I think this last set of Republican primaries, starting with the one that we had in New Hampshire here in January. And, I've always been interested in politics, and I pay attention. And I have, as I say, I wrote another piece for the New York Review of Books about the New Hampshire primary. I don't have a set left and right opinions. I mean, I'm perfectly happy to listen to a Republican if he or she makes sense. But what struck me, listening to various, candidates, including obviously Santorum, who was booed actually in a couple of occasions here in New Hampshire by students. Almost everything they said, Romney, Gingrich, even Ron Paul, except for foreign policy, it was utter nonsense. Mm. Take Ron Paul. What he proposes about to do in this country basically is to abolish the government, to return everything to the states. Now, without thinking through the consequences of something like that.
Right.
The union would break up because the enlightened states would continue to try to have some sort of enlightened existence for most of their citizens. Others wouldn't. There'll be movement of a population. The states would have to raise their own armies to protect their borders, and on and on and on. It's like madness. Not craziness.
I'm afraid we've pretty much run out of time here. Sorry to tell you, Charles Simich, but just to depress you further, I host the UCLA Hammer Forum, which is a public forum where we get speakers to come out and talk about important social and political issues. And I had two operatives who've run campaigns for Democratic presidents and Republican presidents, including the John McCain campaign. And one of the things that both of these said was that the way that politics work in this country in terms of campaigns is that almost all of the money that they raise, and they sell their souls to raise billions and billions of dollars from special interests and now from billionaire super PACs, and most of this money is spent on the media, but they don't spend it across the country. They only spend it on a few states, a handful of states, the so-called swing states. So they ignore the rest of the country. And then as you get close to the elections in October, they then spend all of their money on the 3-6% who are uncommitted and unconvinced. And they both said that the research on that 3-6% who are the deciding vote in deciding our political future is they are the stupidest, the least informed, the least intellectually curious. And by late October, if you haven't made up your mind about the election, you really are, an idiot. And that group are the swing voters that decide our political fate.
I mean, that really is a terrifying vision. I mean, there's an element of a part of the people who have figured this out. There's an element of, both intellectual brilliance and at the same time sheer evil. Total indifference to what happens to the country. The consequences of something like that. And the only way that can be reversed, if I can just briefly say, would be to make this, at least Democrats or somebody, I don't think Democrats are probably eager to do this either, but to point this out. I mean, this needs to, come out in the open. And so at least, we know how the game is played.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Charles.
Well, listen, thank you very much.
Again, Charles Simich is a poet, essayist, and professor emeritus of American literature and creative writing at the University of New Hampshire. He has published some 20 collections of poetry, 6 books of essays, a memoir, and numerous translations. Charles Simich is the recipient of many awards, including the Pulitzer Prize, the Griffin Prize, and the MacArthur Fellowship. And in 2007, he was appointed the 15th Poet Laureate of the United States. His most recent works are Voice at 3 a.m., Master of Disguise, and Confessions of a Poet Laureate. And he has an article or a blog at the New York Review of Books, Age of Ignorance. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with a former Secretary of the Air Force and Special Assistant to President Reagan for National Security.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Reed, a former Secretary of the Air Force during the Ford and Carter administration. He was the youngest ever director of the Super Secret National Reconnaissance Office and was a special assistant to President Reagan for national security policy. His technical background includes nuclear weapons design at Lawrence Livermore and low temperature physics. And his books include At the Abyss, An Insider's History of the Cold War, Nuclear Express, A Political History of the Bomb and Its Proliferation, and his latest just out is Tehran Triangle. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Reed.
Ian, wonderful to be back with you. You are very perceptive. Your audience is too. It's great to be back.
Well, thank you, Thomas. Now, you were very, very involved in the Cold War, which, you know, did end. It's one of the, I think, one of the greatest, most positive things in history was how that frozen, in seemingly intractable relationship that was so dysfunctional because both sides, the more money and treasure they spent on arms and nuclear arms, the less secure they became. Many thought that we could have, and indeed, the record has never been quite fleshed out in terms of how close we came to nuclear war. It's bad enough to have a nuclear war on purpose, but to have one by accident is pretty hideous. But what is so troubling is that this new landscape that we're in now, we seem to have the worst of both worlds in as much as we have psychological disarmament between the United States and Russia, although they physically they still have lots of weapons pointed at each other. But my understanding is, and I'd like to get your response to this, is that we're in a new landscape now where it's actually more likely that a nuclear weapon's going to be used than it was during the Cold War, which was predicated upon the use of nuclear weapons.
I think that's very perceptive, that the Cold War ended. There are, there were heroes in ending it. There was the economist like Harry Rowan of the Intelligence Council who understood the Soviets were going broke and we could end it, and we did. But we're now in a different world, and the problem specifically with Iran that I have thought about and written about is that the Iranians really are not deterred. The Soviets did not believe in the hereafter. The nomenklatura had a good deal. They enjoyed their perks. They wanted to stay alive. The Iranian mullahs are very different. They believe in the 12th imam. They would be willing to go to brink. They're not crazy people, but they are not as deterred as the Soviets were about the possibilities of a nuclear detonation.
But why would deterrence not apply to them, given the robust nature of the Israeli arsenal? And presumably that seems to be their number one obsession is Israel.
Their political obsession is Israel, but they're not going to go nuke Tel Aviv. No, they're not crazy people. The problem is that once Iran gets nukes, that's going to inspire a nuclear spiral in the Mideast. Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Turkey are Sunni nations. They'll go nuclear very quickly. Iran will become a bully. They will control half the world's oil supply. Israel's existence will be in doubt by virtue of political action, Hezbollah in Lebanon and so forth. Iran is not going to go physically attack Israel, but they're going to, Iran would disable the military ability to protect its allies, and the worst of all is Iran would be willing to go to the nuke in political episodes and confrontations with the U.S. Navy, because the view of the leaders are, if worse comes to worst, that is not a terrible thing, that the 12ers, that are the mullahs, really think that they believe in the end of days, and if it all comes with fire and flame, why, that's the way it is. Our gods in heaven will protect us.
So my understanding is that both the CIA and Mossad say that Iran hasn't made the decision to build a nuclear weapon, that they're at least 2 years away from that.
Well, Ian, time has two dimensions. First of all, yes, they made the decision to go nuclear decades ago. The question of actually assembling one, that question has two dimensions. One is time, the other is technology. If you were talking about having a warhead that you can put on a missile and is compact and weighs 100 pounds, that's an engineering challenge. But the other axis is technology. If you're willing to deliver it by boat or train or truck, then all you need is 140 pounds of highly enriched uranium, and you can build a Hiroshima-type bomb in your machine shop. That's what they wrote about.
Well, but my understanding is that, I don't know whether it's a speculation or fact, but I've tried to talk to non-proliferation experts, and there is a suspicion, more than a suspicion, that the AQ Khan network provided the Iranians with a Chinese design that is a fairly mature design. Is that your understanding?
Absolutely. The technology started further back than that. It started in South Africa when the South Africans decided to go nuclear, they canceled that program in 89, and AQ Khan went and harvested all the engineering talent to include into his network. And one of the things that AQ Khan also acquired was the design for what's known as Chick-4, the Chinese very simple implosion enriched uranium bomb. He had that bomb. We found those drawings in Gaddafi's papers when Gaddafi decided to fold his nuclear tent, and there's no doubt that he is offering that design to other nations.
So just in terms of the South African angle, Thomas Reed, my understanding is that I think it was September the 22nd of 1979, during the Carter administration, when you were the Secretary of the Air Force, there was a nuclear event, as it's called, off Namibia in the Atlantic. And I understand that that was a joint South African-Israeli test of a thermonuclear trigger.
In my opinion, the opinion of the nuclear weapons laboratories and my writing partner in Nuclear Express, Danny Stillman from Los Alamos, we all are believing that that was the test of an Israeli nuclear device. It was done with South African logistics support, that I don't believe it was a joint design. That when they folded the program, the president of South Africa made statements that strongly suggested that they were not involved in design. There is a committee that was impaneled by the Carter White House that says no, it wasn't really a nuclear shot, and some very respectable people signed that report, but I disagree. I think the September 79 was a detonation of a 2-kiloton Israeli device with South African logistics support.
Do you think it was a thermonuclear trigger?
Well, that's a little hard to tell. There's no hard intelligence, but from what Stillman and I looked at, our conclusions were that it was a neutron bomb. It was
That's pretty much the same thing, isn't it?
A thermonuclear trigger implies the A bomb you need to fire a thermonuclear.
Right, but
a neutron bomb means it's two stages, and it lights a second stage that is all fission, and it creates a lot of neutrons, and we think that's really what Israel needed for its tactical considerations, and that's what they shot.
Right. Well, that was my understanding, too, but there was no quid pro quo, you're saying, between the Israelis and the South Africans, and that the South Africans, when they dismantled their program, a lot of the intellectual capital ended up with AQ Khan? Is that what you're telling us?
Well, let's back up. You know, there was a quid pro quo. The agreements were signed in April of 75. We have copies of the signed pages with Sherman Peresh and the headman in South Africa. Basically, the quid pro quo was Israel would provide technology to South Africa along with a supply of tritium, which you need for triggers and other things. In exchange, the South Africans would provide uranium because it's a byproduct of gold mining, so they had it piled all over the place, and they would provide the wide-open spaces of the deserts and their ocean territories for testing. That was the quid pro quo. That the resulting product was the Israelis gave the South Africans advice on how to build nuclear weapons, but I do not believe there was a joint nuclear weapon. But what happened when the South Africans folded their tent in 89, they had a whole bunch of people, not that were just bomb designers, but they were engineers that know how to make centrifuges. That's what AQ Khan collected, is the engineers that understood how to make centrifuges, the plumbing and the joints and the balance and all that technology. And that's what he began to proliferate to other places, including Iran.
Well, those centrifuges are obviously a very complicated piece of engineering. I think they spin at something like 78,000 RPM. But my understanding is that the Israeli Stuxnet computer virus really did put a crimp in the Iranian centrifuge program. But I've also been told that there that they've overcome it, and they've got thousands of them operating in these arrays.
No, you got exactly the right word, Ian. The Stuxnet virus put a crimp into the Iranian program. It slowed it down. You're right. Centrifuges have to spin at well over 78, maybe as much as 100,000 RPM. That the Stuxnet virus basically got the centrifuges to overspeed and fly apart. That the Iranians are busy fixing that. But one of the people in charge of fixing it was one of the scientists that was blown up by a car bomb attached by a motorcycle. There's a tough war already going on.
So your book, Thomas Reed, the former Secretary of the Air Force during the Ford and Carter administration, the youngest ever director of the Super Secret National Reconnaissance Office and Special Assistant to President Reagan for National Security Policy, and the author of the new book, The Tehran Triangle. It's a fictional book, but clearly, since you've had this extraordinary experience at the highest levels of national security in the United States government and also have designed nuclear weapons, you bring an extraordinary amount of knowledge to the table here, which you've put into this fictional book, The Tehran Triangle. In many ways, it's easier to write fiction than nonfiction to make your point, you know? Is that your motive?
Well, first of all, no, it's not easier. It's harder for us historians. First of all, it is basically, I would describe it as a historical thriller, a coup history, the last chapter of which has not yet been written. All the history from 79, South Africa, HQ Khan and so forth, up to the end of 2011, is true. It all happened. We had to invent some characters to carry the story. But the characters even are authentic. They are based on real people. All that's happened is that the end game, the nuclear end game of 2012, has not yet played itself out. And so we proposed one possible end game. It's an extrapolation. Life may not turn out that way. We invented created a story of what the Iranians could do is to find a disgruntled second-generation Iranian living in Texas whose cousin got killed, to assemble a Hiroshima technology bomb in an El Paso machine shop. And all he needs is 140 pounds of uranium smuggled in from Tehran into Mexico and across the border by the drug gangs. That part is one possible ending. Maybe things will turn out differently, but all the rest from 79 up today is absolutely true.
But the thing that's the sword of Damocles, if you will, which we had during the Cold War, it's still hanging by a thread. And as we started out our conversation, that one of the ironies of the post-Cold War is that it's actually more likely that a nuclear weapon will go off because people are more determined to use them without, you know, ascribing necessarily to the Iranians that they're, you know, crazy. But the point is that what's keeping us from this bomb going off somewhere or, you know, a nuclear car bomb without a signature, which is the real nightmare, because that gets around deterrence. If you don't know what the return address is, then people aren't deterred from using these weapons. But doesn't it come down to the fissile material? In other words, we know AQ Khan, and for reasons that mystify me, why the Chinese have been so loose in their nuclear weapons designs getting out there, and that the Pakistanis have been loose about it. So there's a lot of people who know how to build a bomb, but what they don't have their hands on is the fissile material. And it's the protection of fissile material that's basically keeping the world safe at this moment. Is that right?
Absolutely. You cover a lot of bases, Ian, but the bottom line is absolutely it's the control of fissile materials. And a fissile material cutoff treaty is very important. To go back a little bit, when the Soviet Empire fell, a lot of fissile material, plutonium and rich uranium, was unaccounted for. The Soviets, I think, knew where their bombs were, but they really didn't know where their plutonium and their uranium was. And so they produced tons of the stuff, and maybe they accounted for 99% of it, but 1% of tons is still enough for plutonium or enriched uranium for dozens of weapons. So the question, first of all, is where in the former Soviet Union? We opened the Tehran Triangle with a story about Kazakhstan, where there was several hundred pounds of the stuff that the U.S. and the Iranians were competing for in the 90s. Fissile material is the problem. It is, I agree with you, that there is a very strong possibility of a nuclear device going off because the controls are so much less because there's so many different countries that have gained the technology. And the Chinese absolutely were instrumental in training the Pakistanis in how to design and build nuclear weapons.
But is it possible that you can, in between the possession of potential fissile material or real fissile material and not building a bomb? Because I understand the Swedes in the 60s went up to the brink and then pulled back and decided they didn't want to do it. Japan has an enormous amount of plutonium. Presumably they have the ability to design weapons. A lot of people think that they could go nuclear very quickly, and that's one of the concerns about North Korea, is that if things start to escalate there, and as you mentioned earlier, the real problem with Iran is that the Saudis will then want a weapon. They could probably buy one from Pakistan, who knows? But, I mean, it obviously is going to escalate. So let's take the Japan model. Can you live with that in this 21st century?
Japan example is exactly right. Japan could go nuclear within a year. If a nation has reactors, if they have engineering talent, if they have resources and money, then they can go nuclear within a year. Japan clearly could do that. The principal reason they don't is they rely on the U.S. nuclear umbrella. Same thing with Germany. That's one of the important things of the U.S. nuclear inventory, is to assure our allies. That you're right. The Swedes had a nuclear program. They decided to quit. The Swiss had one. They were planning 8 shots under the Alps, and they decided it was a waste of money. But they could go. But they were starting from fundamentals. But Japan has the reactors. They have the material. Same thing with Iran. Iran does not have reactors, but they have centrifuges. They have the material, and all it requires is the decision to put it together. As mentioned earlier, if you wanted to do a missile warhead, that takes some sophisticated engineering. If you're going to deliver it by a boat or a truck, it does not take engineering. That's World War II technology. Anybody can do it. All it's required is a political decision.
Well, we could talk on for a long time. I'm afraid, though, Tom, that we're out of time here. So, again, I recommend your book, and I just hope that the worst doesn't happen. But I must say, after having been a student of the Cold War, and of course you were deeply involved in it, that was one of the best things that ever happened, was that ended. But then a whole new landscape of subnational and transnational threats have emerged, and nobody seems to have a handle on it.
That is true.
Well, I thank you again for joining us.
Ian, I appreciate you having me. It is really challenging times, and it's been a delight talking about it. Thanks for asking.
Well, thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Reed, who's a former Secretary of the Air Force during the Ford and Carter administration. He was the youngest ever director of the Super Secret National Reconnaissance Office and was a special assistant to President Reagan for national security policy. His technical background includes nuclear weapons design at Lawrence Livermore and low temperature physics, and his books include At the Abyss, an insider's history of the Cold War, Nuclear Express, A Political History of the Bomb and Its Proliferation, and his latest book just out is The Tehran Triangle. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the director of a new film about the president of an island that is sinking due to global warming.
So let's surprise them, we'll drop the big one, pulverize them. The Asia's crowded, Europe's too old, Africa's far too hot, and Canada's too cold. South America stole our name. Let's drop the big one. There'll be no one left to blame us. We'll save Australia.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Schenck, the filmmaker of the new film, The Island President, a documentary that follows Mohamed Nasheed's first year as president of the Maldives, culminating in the carbon emissions battle at the 2009 Copenhagen Climate Summit. He was the director of photography for the Academy Award-winning Smile Pinky, won an Emmy for Blame Somebody Else, a 2007 PBS expose, and directed and photographed Lost Boys of Sudan, the Independent Spirit Award winner of 2004. and he has been twice nominated for Emmys for his cinematography. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Shank.
Thank you for having me.
And the film, of course, opens tomorrow at the New Art here in Los Angeles. And your main character, Mohamed Nasheed, who resigned from the presidency of the Maldives under threat of violence from a coup d'etat from the security forces loyal to the former dictator, and the film chronicles his first year in office. But the subtext here, of course, is the fact that this man leads a nation that is disappearing physically, literally, because of global warming.
Yeah, you know, the Maldives is considered by people who study climate change, you know, scientists, as the most vulnerable nation on the planet. It's 1,200 islands in the middle of the Indian Ocean. The islands are, you know, flat pancakes. The highest altitude is about a meter and a half. There are no hills, and they're one of the places in the world where they're already experiencing the effects of the sea level that has changed.
And what led you to chronicling the story of this man? This is an island, a chain of islands in the Indian Ocean, not exactly the first stop on most people's itinerary.
Yeah, you know, Nasheed is just, he's a once-in-a-lifetime guy. He's just an absolutely incredible figure. He's in his 40s now, but he spent, you know, basically his entire adult life working for civil rights and democracy in the Maldives. He's almost kind of like a Martin Luther King type figure. He spent much of his life in prison, and he was tortured by the former dictator. And then finally, after years of nonviolent protest, he and his group were able to force elections, and then miraculously he prevailed and became the president of the country. The story, his backstory alone, is just absolutely, you know, inspiring and amazing. But then you add to that this incredible, you know, task that he took on once he got to be president, which is that he immediately plunged himself into the international politics of climate change and trying to get attention for the vulnerable countries of the world. And it's just, the film itself becomes kind of this David Goliath story. You know, he's a leader of this tiny little country, almost of inconsequential population, 400,000 people. And yet he is able to eventually go to Copenhagen and sit down, force himself to position at the table with, you know, leaders of China, the U.S., the European Union, and then actually have an impact on the outcome that happened to Copenhagen.
Well, the nemesis in the film, though, this is that, you know, the hero, if you will, who you've profiled in the film, the island president, Mohamed Nasheed, he's fought for 20-year battle against this brutal regime of Mamoun Abdel Gayoom. And, I mean, he lost. Isn't that, that's not exactly a happy ending.
Well, you know, yes and no. I mean, in 2008, they actually... the Maldivian Democratic Party won, and Nasheed became the president. And you know, since then we filmed his first year in office, which largely chronicles his work in the climate arena. That's sort of the through line of a lot of the film. Subsequently, just as you know, we were releasing the film in the last couple of months, he has been dealt this blow, which is that, you know, these loyalists to the former dictator were able to pay off the police and the military and force Nasheed from office at gunpoint. And it is a blow. It is a loss. But, you know, the amazing thing about Nasheed is that you would expect him to, you know, finally maybe, you know, to sort of cry uncle after all these years. But he immediately stepped back into the streets and is now the leader of yet another democratic movement there. And every day in the Maldives you see tens of thousands of people on the streets in support of Nasheed and democracy. You know, one thing is that, you know, now that democracy has been flourishing there for a few years, you know, along with that, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, young people in the Maldives have really felt these new freedoms intensely, and it seems that they're not going to give them up lightly. So, you know, I think that it's really a story without an ending in a lot of ways.
Again, I'm speaking with John Schenck, who is the filmmaker of the new film, The Island President, a feature documentary that follows Mohamed Nasheed's first year as president of the Maldives, culminating in the carbon emissions battle at the 2009 Copenhagen Climate Summit. And what is at stake, though, here in terms of the politics of the island? Is this just a case of a courageous Democrat fighting for justice against a bunch of corrupt thugs, or is there some ulterior motive on the part of those that would support the deposed dictator and the thugs that conducted this coup against the hero of your film? In other words, are there any other outside forces at work here, or is this just really, you know, bare-knuckle local politics?
Well, you know, it's you know, at the end of the day, I'm a filmmaker and a storyteller, and I you know, felt that Nasheed would be just an incredible story to put at the center of a documentary, and he really, you know, proves that way beyond my wildest dreams. He's just, you know, just became just this incredible figure during the time that we were filming. In terms of what's going on in the Maldives now, you know, Nasheed was trying to do and continues to try to do a seemingly impossible task, which is that he's trying to bring democracy to a country that has never had democracy. The Maldives has been, you know, sitting there in the middle of the Indian Ocean with civilization for, you know, 2,000 plus years, and they've never had democracy. It's always been ruled by, you know, sultans and kings, and, you know, the latest of which was this strongman dictator, Gayoom, who ruled the country with fear and loathing for 30 years up until the elections in 08. And, you know, along with that type of autocracy comes just a vast amount of, you know, intricate web of corruption. You know, businesses that were used to having monopoly deals on things like importing fuel or, you know, other aspects of the economy. And you can only imagine that when you try to undo that with, you know, new tax structures, with, you know, with health care for the population, with, you know, with transportation systems that would go out to bid to, you know, several different contractors rather than just being given to friends and family. Nasheed was just, he was tweaking this old guard at every turn, and ultimately they decided they had had enough, and they resorted to their old ways, which is the one thing they know how to do, which is to use, you know, kind of force and to use military might to essentially elbow their way back into office.
But of course, the irony is, I'm sure it's escaped on these thugs, is that they're all going to go under together, right? I mean, is there any kind of, I guess I'm imposing a kind of an American frame on this, because I'm, you know, one's aware of the constituency here in the United States of global warming deniers that are funded by ExxonMobil and other big corporations and the Koch brothers to perpetuate this denial of reality.
Well, you know, I think a couple interesting things. One is, I think that there's no doubt that, you know, the governments of the world, many of which are influenced by economic forces like you're talking about, are just failing to step up and provide leadership on an issue that ultimately is going to impact us all. And I think, you know, another kind of interesting thing about the film is that, you know, Nasheed at one point says, you know, look, you know, he sort of throws up his arms in frustration and says at one point, like, you know, why can't we just all, you know, put down this kind of petty, these petty battles that we're having, you know, tribal disputes and economic disputes, and realize that our Earth is being, you know, threatened. And, you know, it's almost like it feels like an action hero type of movie. And it does at times, I think, feel like a thriller, in the sense that you have a impending kind of disaster that's happening to the planet. And you have a hero on the other hand, in the Nasheed character, that's trying to wake the world up and to get something done before the ticking time bomb, so to speak, goes off. And yet, as you say, there are just so many kind of, you know, what I'd like to think of as just kind of short-sighted, kind of petty things that are working against him, and that includes obviously the financial gain of people that, you know, that have these companies, and the political gain of people who are in power in various parts of the world. And it's just, it's a frustrating thing. You know, it's climate change is just has been a very difficult kind of issue for people to grab a hold of because it's abstract in a lot of ways. It's something that's going to happen in the future, and I think the kind of eye-opening thing about Nasheed is that for him it's so real. You know, his islands are already being eroded. He's already very scared about where his children are going to live and his grandchildren are going to live. And so I think when you look into the eyes of somebody who's actually being affected by this, it's much easier in a way to start to think, oh my gosh, you know, these are real people. This is a real place. This is really threatened. This is not a film with charts and graphs and scientific argument. It's a film about people who are seeing something happen and they're fighting, to try to, you know, essentially for survival.
And again, I'm speaking with John Schenck, the filmmaker of the new film, The Island President, a documentary feature that follows Mohamed Nasheed's first year as the president of the Maldives. And the film opens tomorrow at the New Art here in Los Angeles. And it's amazing, though, that you were able to have the kind of access that you had. You'd never get it over here or in most countries where you literally experience what it's like running a country, you know, and albeit this collection of, 1,200 coral atolls, 200 of which are inhabited and all of them are slowly being swallowed up by the ocean because of global warming. But what's so haunting about your film, John, is the incredible beauty of the place. I mean, then the haunting music of Radiohead sort of brings it forth. It's spectacularly beautiful. I mean, that, I guess, just makes it even more tragic.
Yeah, you know, when I first saw the Maldives, when I landed there for the first time, I was looking down over these islands, and you've seen the film, so you noticed how gorgeous they are. And I had the thought, oh my gosh, this is amazing. You know, as an American, I've never really seen anything like this. I kept thinking, this is what it was like to, you know, see the Grand Canyon for the first time before I knew what that was. You know, it's that impressive in terms of just how beautiful it is, a piece of nature. And then literally a half a second later, I had the thought, oh my God, they're so fragile. You know, it's almost like an accident of nature that it exists. And then immediately your heart goes to, wow, you know, we need to save these places. And then when you meet the people there and you meet Nasheed himself, who's kind of the embodiment of that, you know, that passion to want to survive, your heart really starts to go out to, you know, wanting to be part of the solution, so to speak.
But what's so powerful about the film is the contrast between the beauty of this place and the threat of this jewel disappearing. But the film culminates with the Copenhagen Climate Summit of 2009, where you see the worst of Western politics and backroom dealing, right?
Yeah, you know, it's the film is kind of it's a very kind of strange, you know, I think kind of wonderful mix of a lot of different stuff. In some ways, it's a nature film. You get to see these beautiful islands and the ecosystem there. But you also, I think, you know, when we were making this film, actually when we were pitching the film to Nasheed, we were trying to come up with other films that he could watch that would show him what we were trying to do. And we realized that actually there was no other film like this that like you said, the type of access that we were aiming to get and ultimately achieved in the film is just something highly unusual. You're following a head of state around. You know, you're in his home. You're, you know, looking at his strategy meetings in his hotel rooms, and you're in his cabinet meetings. And then ultimately, you see him, you know, when he meets bilaterally with other heads of state and other ministers from other countries. And it almost has like a, I don't know, like you said, it's like you're sort of jetting around the world, and you know, you go in from these beautiful scenes in the Maldives to the back rooms in Copenhagen, and I think it's very exciting. I think it's a very eye-opening view of international politics, and I think that as much as you get to know Nasheed, I think it also helps personalize and make real the conversations that are going on at the highest level. And you do see, like you said, you see that there's a lot of sort of politicking and leaders that are seem less interested in making a deal than they are in preserving their kind of status on the world stage. And so it's just, it really lays bare a lot of really crucial issues that the world is facing today.
Well, just in closing, John Shank, how have the people in the Maldives reacted to the film?
We had one of the most meaningful experiences of my life, actually, was taking the film back to the Maldives in November. We did about a 10-day little mini theatrical run in the capital there, and it was just amazing. The press at that time, Nasheed was still in office. The press was very free, and there was just a lot of reviews of the film. And I think people they were just stunned by it. I think they had been living under an autocracy where, there was one state-run television station for 30 years, and suddenly they have this film, and they were living in the world of Gayoom was one in which, he would step out in front of the cameras once a week or whatever, and he would wave and read a prepared statement. And then you compare that to the president that they see in the island president, which is a guy who's just a renegade, kind of mischievous, funny, charming character who runs around and he scuba dives and, they did this incredible stunt where they held a cabinet meeting underwater, and he's just he's very human. And so they walked out of it just thinking that they had an incredible leader, and that they were very proud that the Maldives could play the role that it's playing in the climate change debate. So I it was really just an incredible moment for me to see how a film and the media that comes from it can really have an impact on a population.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us today, John Shank.
Thank you very much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with John Shank, who is the filmmaker of the new film, The Island President, a feature documentary that follows Mohamed Nasheed's first year as president of the Maldives, culminating in the carbon emissions battle at the 2009 Copenhagen Climate Summit. He's twice nominated for Emmys and is a director of photography for the Academy Award-winning Smile Pinky. He won an Emmy for Blame Somebody Else, a 2007 PBS expose, and directed and photographed Lost Boys of Sudan, the Independent Spirit Award winner of 2004. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.